Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a new special episode of the Film Stage Show. I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, and I'm here with you today because I was recently able to catch a preview screening of the new film Upstream Color by writer, director, editor, composer Shane Carruth, who previously released Primer back in 2004. Now, a couple of notes before we get into the interview itself. After the film, there was a Q&A with Shane, and most of the questions in that Q&A focused on questions of plot and pretty basic questions regarding how he came upon the idea of this film. So I tried to stay away from rote questions like that and get a little more insight into his process and a couple of very specific instances of how he might have been influenced. So you don't really have to worry about spoilers. There's not going to be any big reveals here, though we do get into the themes that are going to be present in the film. Now, as to the question of when you can see this film, check out upstreamcolor.com for any information regarding when it's coming to a theater near you. One final note, sorry if the audio is not as perfect as you're used to. Unfortunately, when you're recording in the field, sometimes production values suffer. But regardless of that, enjoy this interview with Upstream Color director Shane Carruth.
audio recording. So, how's it feel to be back in the D.C. area?
I wish I was here longer. I just got here last night, and I'm about to get on a train and go back to New York. Wow. My sister lives in Alexandria, and that's where we used to live as well. And I don't even have time to see her.
That's unfortunate.
I mean, it's fine. I'm lucky to be able to do this, but it's funny. I just don't even feel like I'm here.
So yeah, I was at the Q&A last night, so I'm going to attempt to avoid all the questions that were already asked.
Wow, this is fantastic. This is great.
And in fact, one of my first questions actually has to do with the Q&A, because you had said yourself, this is usually the moment where you go out to a cafe or something or a bar and talk with your friends about the movie, and what did you think? And here were people who were kind of skipping over that and going straight to you, looking for the author's answer.
Sure. Yeah, but not their fault, obviously.
No, I mean you're there.
Engaging in it, yeah.
But I mean, is that kind of... is that weird at all when that happens? Because you created a film that kind of begs to be thought about, and here are people who are immediately able to...
Yeah, I mean, sorry, this is something I've said before, so I'm sorry to repeat myself. Is that...
That's fine.
Okay. It's a lot like telling a joke, and instead of somebody laughing, they ask you, oh, okay, well, why was that funny? It almost doesn't really matter. Like, you can explain it, but if somebody didn't laugh, then it doesn't really matter why it was supposed to be funny. That's sort of what it can feel like. It's just weird because I'm absolutely culpable and engaging in it, so I shouldn't be complaining. But I'm still trying to figure out what would be appropriate. Because is it, you know, for instance, is it a work comes out and then a year later, once people have decided what they think of it or whether they even care to think of it, maybe that author shows up on something dry and staid and, you know, Charlie Rose, and they do a thorough owning up to, yes, that was the intent, or no, that wasn't, and who knows if that's appropriate, who knows if Q&As are appropriate, who knows if me shutting my mouth or all authors shutting their mouth indefinitely is appropriate. But it's, for a film like this, that's telegraphing so much that it that is an exploration. I can only really do harm to show up at the end of it after the credits roll and start, you know, being very specific.
Okay. And are there any kind of questions that you wish that you'd get from people that have kind of been elided over in the rush to understand the film in a plot sense?
Honestly, no. I mean, the thing is, I'm lucky to do this, but this is a compromise. Mm-hmm. I don't have any questions for my... the authors of my favorite work. I don't have questions for them. I don't at first. I want to go puzzle this apart. I want to talk to friends. I want to see, that's how narrative works, I think, or how film works at least. If it's compelling at all, then it's like you want to solve that challenge, hopefully. And I certainly don't want the answer key, from the author. So it's hard. I don't know what question would... I don't know.
Yeah, because I was thinking about it, because when there was even a point yesterday where I kind of thought, like, I don't want the Q&A. Like, I wanted to go out and think about it myself. And it's weird because, you know, as a fan of your work, in addition to being a journalist, it's like, well, I should be here. And then that's how I figured out, you know, I'll hear everything that he says now and then try to avoid it altogether.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, well, I'm glad it's going to work out, hopefully. There was one thing I wanted to revisit, though.
Sure.
Walden. And you had said how you kind of stumbled upon it. You were looking for, like, a passive read. And the thing is that Walden is, and, you know, Henry David Thoreau, very into transcendentalism, mm-hmm. you know, the idea of interconnectedness of all of nature and man. So was that a theme that once you found Walden, you tried to embellish more, or was that another thing that was just surprisingly synchronistic between the book and the movie that you were making?
I guess it was surprisingly synchronistic, and I still don't know how to explain it, really. I picked the title of the book based on two major things that I needed to have solved. One, I've got this plot that is embedded in the natural world, this life cycle exists in that way, and I need a piece of fiction that I can have Chris be forced to write and rewrite over and over again. That was the important part, that she'd be constructing these paper chains from, you know, pages of rewritten narrative. So I needed a title, and so I picked Walden, thinking that it was serving both of those, and that it's a, you know, a passive read. It's not, you know, it's not so exciting that it would snap her out of her hypnotic state, and that's why. And then when I started to find language in it that was like eerily appropriate to the film, I played that up. But to be honest, I it would be an exaggeration to say that the film's not a reaction to Walden. So there really isn't any comment to be had about transcendentalism, although they do both say something about that. But Upstream wasn't necessarily meant to be about how things are connected. They're more about being affected at a distance. And because of that, that leads to a curiosity and, you know, of hands searching edges and tactility and suspicions about light and halos of light and soundscapes and being connected in a way that you can't communicate. So the way the film communicates that is by using sound and having our characters lost in sound and having those sounds blend together. And that says something that I don't think you can verbalize. I mean, you could try. You could say, oh, they are connected, but they don't know it. And they're lost in thought about nothing in particular, but that thought is really each other. Like, you can say these words, but they don't really mean anything. But hopefully that's when film can use its aesthetic elements to sort of get past what you could say. So in that sense, anyway, sorry, it's not trying to say that all things are connected. It's trying to use the idea that all things are connected to convey the subjective experience and being affected at a distance by things you can't talk about or to.
Okay.
That doesn't make any sense. I mean, I think it does, but,
it's fine. We've recorded it so people can play it back if they need to hear it again.
Yeah. That was a lot of words.
And then speaking about the interconnectedness, that the way that the two characters find one another, and they kind of begin to, it's a very interesting interplay, because not only do they begin to lose themselves inside of one another, they have the melding of personalities.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny because there was actually a This American Life episode, if you're familiar with the radio program.
Oh, yeah.
It's about, I think it's reruns, and it was people who, one of the chapters was about people who tell stories all the time. And there was a couple where the man had begun to tell the story that his wife told and had been inserting himself into it.
Yeah.
And so it made me think about that during the movie. Like, that's, you don't need to, it's going to sound weird saying this.
That's
you don't
exactly
need to be, like, infected with the worm to have it. It's something that happens all the time.
I've sort of been talking about that, because there's a lot of things in the film where, like, Chris and Jeff's entire relationship, for the most part, is that.
Yeah.
It's basically a sequence of moments that you don't actually need the artificial weirdness around them to make those moments happen. When they're meeting on the train and all signs point to this should be a romantic encounter of some kind, and it goes weird and south and full of agitation, you don't need them to be connected to pigs in a corral somewhere else in the world for that to happen. but in our story it does.
Right.
Because it's a way to now represent all of these things that we can't quite speak to. Like, why, if on paper we're meant to get along, why is this here? Where's this agitation coming from? That's a very purposeful thing in the film. Everything that they're doing has a, you know, analog to the real world. Even the shared memories thing, although it's an exaggeration of it, I feel like that's a version of things that people, I respond to, I guess, or I recognize, is telling a story and being absolutely certain that I know how it's meant to go. Or I was there, or it was on Thursday, not Tuesday, or no, it was, we were in your car, not mine. Like knowing something, and then being shown that, nope, that's wrong. That actually didn't happen that way.
Yeah. And it's a very subtly, almost like terrifying idea.
Yes.
Because it is, it goes into that same theme of, you know, losing yourself, you know, losing your own authorship over your narrative.
Yeah. Like, where does one person end and the other begin? And that's that sequence, you know, it's meant to be, it starts off really light and sort of fanciful. And isn't this fun that we don't remember whose story is whose? And by the end of it, it's just a real source of agitation and frustration. Because, where do you stop encroaching on my identity?
And speaking of that, the way that the scene is constructed, I mean, and the way that almost the entire movie is constructed, like, it's almost entirely like montage. There's not like a single like set piece scene.
Yeah.
And in creating a film like that, you kind of open the audience up to more opportunities for confusion if they're not as invested. So when you decided to make it that way, when it was constructed in that way, was that more of an investment in your trust in yourself than your ability to pull it off? Or was it also kind of mixed in with an investment and a trust in the audience being able to keep up with you?
Huh. I was going to say one thing before that. I'm trying to pull some clips now for exclusives for like websites or for potentially TV or whatever. And I'm just meant to pull these like 60-second clips from the film. And because it's so montage-y, it's really, really hard to find 60 seconds that will make any real sense out of context. So I thought that was funny. As you were saying it, I was like, yeah, you're right. It's a nightmare. it's both. It's not a faith in my ability. It's more, this isn't completely true, this is just partially true, but really the only audience I know how to write and execute a film for is an audience that roughly looks and thinks like me.
Right.
Not looks, but thinks like me. So that's, you know, that's the way I would want to receive information. For this story, for what it needs to do, that's what I think is appropriate if I was the viewer. And so I'm confident or hopeful that there are people that want that too, that are like me. So that's almost all there is to that.
Yeah. Well, considering the amount of buzz, I think it's pretty obvious that there are people who are searching for that same thing.
Yeah. I hope so.
It seems,
or we're
like
just ready for the backlash. Who knows? We'll see.
There's always going to be backlash.
I know.
How does that affect you? I mean, like, is it knowing that it's going to be not embraced by everyone, is knowing how you fit into a niche, does that help to inoculate you against probably some of the stuff that's going to be said?
Well, I don't care so much what anybody thinks of me. I mean, I have insecurity and I don't, you know, whatever, but I am interested in work that potentially has a chance to be relevant far in the future, down the line. And that doesn't mean that I think that everything I do that's in front of me is necessarily going to be relevant. But what it does mean is if I ever suspect that it has no chance, then I'll just quit or change it or do something. Cause that's just the way I think of how narrative can be, part of our shared understanding. So, really my only care in modern day is this work in front of me getting to a large enough awareness point in culture that it has a chance to live on its own for a bit and be accepted or rejected or critiqued or ignored enough to see whether it has it's relevant into the future. That's my job right now. And so a negative review is a negative review, positive review is that. They are only indicators of whether this thing has a chance. Mm-hmm. They don't mean much to me. I'm not interested in what it means for me personally, like as far as a career or whatever. With the one caveat that now that the film looks to be on a trajectory to at least have some level of awareness, I mean, I will happily admit that now the revenue for it is directly connected to a story that I'm writing right now that I hope to be shooting soon. So it's sort of like I've got one kid out the door towards school,
right?
And now I've got to figure out how to pay for the next kid's tuition. And so my mind is sort of there as well.
Is that something that, I mean, Kickstarter's been in the news a lot, and Indiegogo and things like that, crowdsourcing's become a huge thing. Have you put any thought into that, or?
I have, yeah. I still don't have a final decision. I'm interested in it. I'm trying to figure out where my comfort is with it. And I think it would have to be something transactional, where basically there's only one thing available that somebody could put money towards, and that's mm-hmm. a pre-order on a download or Blu-ray that's coming in 12 to 18 months. I wouldn't want to do something that was promoted the idea that there are fans.
Right.
I don't like that concept. I'm happy with consumerism.
Right.
I think that's the equivalent of, you know, you used to ask a wealthy landowner or a king to commission work, and you'd go to one person, and hopefully they would be able to pay for the work. And now we're in a situation where you can go to everybody and just get a little bit from a lot of different people. So I'm completely happy with that. I just don't want, I don't like the idea of of pretending that there are fans. Mm-hmm. Even if it's true, even if I'm technically a fan of my favorite work, it feels uneven. It feels like there's a hierarchy that doesn't feel right. Anyways.
Yeah, because it's kind of asking to pledge fealty to an idea,
yes,
rather than actually getting anything back from it.
Yes, yes. And that's the thing, is like it's I want it, you know, I can only think about it being symbiotic. Like,
right.
I receive work from other people. I enjoy their work. I hope that I can create work that other people can enjoy and be, you know, have a conversation with. And I don't ever want to have the face of somebody who thinks that they're being supported by, you know, a group of people that are fans or whatever that means. It's weird. I've never really talked about this before, but yeah. That's
weird. I mean, it's, you know, like I said, it's been in the news a lot, so it's something
yeah.
to think about. And I was interested because it is, you know, hopefully for independent projects and stuff like that. So
no, absolutely. Evan Gladell and Coat Wolf, the group of people that those filmmakers that did The Bellflower.
Mm-hmm.
They just raised a significant amount of money with Indiegogo, doing their campaign. It's really cool to see.
And I had one question that was, it's kind of related to the film, not so much in a plot sense, but in a sense of how you created it and conceptualized it. So hopefully it still strays away from the rote stuff that you've probably heard before. But did you, the way that these people are connected, the organ merchants, the sampler, and then the thief,
mm-hmm.
They don't know each other.
Right.
They're completely unaware of one another's existence. When you were creating it, it's easy to create kind of a happenstance triangle that continues to move in a circular fashion. But did you ever try to conceive of a way in which they all could have discovered this power or this thing that they're doing?
Like the origin of it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. That was in a version of the script where we would get some sense of how they came to know how to do what they're doing.
Okay.
Basically, they all would have had a counterpart that had shown them, but it was a counterpart where you could understand how that counterpart had another counterpart or a mentor before them.
So it would have been a kind of continuation of that, you know, perpetuating cycle.
Yeah. And I lost it mainly because it felt a bit like we're leaning too heavily on talking about this cycle.
Right.
And, you know, this story, and it has to be Chris's exploration, and the rest of it is a storm of, you know, artificial constructs, basically, that I've done my best to make sure that they're still pointing to the in the same direction thematically. I mean, like, I was, did we talk about that, like, how it's meant to be not a specific thing but a universal thing, like the construct itself? Sorry, I'm getting conversations confused.
I don't believe so.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's you know, meant to be embedded in nature, meant to be
right,
like, outside our experience. And so the you know, the loop is meant to satisfy that. So I guess that's what I mean. Is in that way, it's like, it's the construct is there to support the theme, not just to be compelling, or hopefully compelling. Sorry, I'm getting lost. I'm getting lost. I think I've done a loop on myself.
This conversation
just
got meta. You were talking about why you decided to remove it, the story of the origin.
Yeah, because it was focusing too much on those elements.
The mechanism.
There. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Yeah.
And that was one of the things that I liked about the film, was the fact that, and I said this to someone as we were leaving, they asked me what I thought about it, and I said that one of my favorite things is that I knew what was happening, and I knew specifically why it was happening, but I had no greater idea of why it was happening.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to draw the connections between everyone, and I was able to kind of intuit, if one action occurs, then this is the probable next action.
Mm-hmm.
And there's basically no exposition.
Right.
It was all conveyed through action and the montage that you'd created.
Mm-hmm.
Was it particularly hard to do that? And was it difficult in the writing?
Yeah. I mean, it actually, as the tools came together and as the visual language came together and the music came together and then a few other things, there's just a period of a few weeks, I guess, running up into production. And then after, you know, 1 week or so into technically production. I mean, you know, Casey and I shot some stuff before we even casted. So this has been going on for a while. But as these tools were coming together, it became more and more clear that what can be communicated non-verbally. And is there a chance to start stripping away some of this other stuff that might be in there? And I'd already started doing that in the writing process because I did want to keep that stuff to a minimum. But there was still a little bit in there. It finally got removed as well. Once I felt like these other tools are being more than effective enough for what we need to be communicating. I mean, it is. I'm hopefully learning more and more about it. But that was a learning process. I don't know. It's what it boils down to is I just. I'm just more and more certain that I am not smart enough to know everything in the writing stage. So the music needs to happen concurrently, the cinematography or the visual language needs to happen concurrently, editing, a lot of other, like, production design, all of these things need to ramp up. They need to start having a conversation with each other. They need to change and be affected by each other. And then we should start production. But the idea of their, okay, script's locked, okay, nobody does the music before they do the film, but so that I shouldn't be locking the music before that. Anyways, we need to do like a fake version of, we need to have like a band, or the way a band rehearses,
mm-hmm,
for a month before they go on tour. That's what needs to happen. And maybe that does happen on other films, and maybe I just don't know about it, but I just know it's becoming more and more important for all of that to happen. Yeah.
Well, that is unfortunately all the time we have.
Okay.
So, thank you very much.
Oh, of course. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
So that's it, guys. Hopefully you enjoyed it, and hopefully it gives you some insight into what you might be in for when you do get around to see Upstream Color, which, again, you can find out its release patterns at upstreamcolor.com. And if you're wondering, or left ambiguous after the interview that I did, I can say 100% emphatically that you ought to see this movie, And in addition to this interview, make sure to check out the full Film Stage Show episode that Nick and Danny and I record on this film as it begins to hit a little more wide release. So thank you very much, and hey, tune in next time.